Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. With us today, we have one of our country's preeminent, well, both practitioners and experts on the Middle East. His name is Dr. David Wormser. I'm very proud to say he is a senior fellow director of our Middle East programs at the Center for Security Policy. He is a world-class naval intelligence officer, former assistant to the Vice President of the United States, the National Security Advisor, Undersecretaries of State, and others. He is a formidable intellect as well as a great friend, and we're always delighted to have him. Dr. David Wormser, welcome back to Securing America.
Thanks, Frank. It's really always an honor to be with you.
Thank you. Let me talk to you about a couple of things briefly, because there's a lot to cover here and not a lot of time. The Middle East is a mess and becoming more so by the day. Of particular concern is my sense that we're sort of seeing a lot of people sort of pushing sparks into the tinderbox of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, as it's been called. I'm interested in your take on where that stands at the moment. And am I right that there seem to be a lot of people trying to, well, create, if not sort of out of whole cloth, certainly exacerbate the Palestinian ambitions for a new intifada against Israel?
Absolutely. You know, in December 2016, just before President Trump took office and just after the elections, there was a vote in the United Nations that essentially declared the Temple Mount, Western Wall, really all of East Jerusalem, to be Palestinian territory occupied by Israel. It essentially recognized the Palestinian claim to the land and annulled the Jewish claim. And the United States abstained. And what that did is brought into question the whole Jewish presence on the Temple Mount. And ever since then, what you've seen is an escalating set of challenges to Israel's sovereignty over the Temple Mount.
And remind us very quickly, David, what the significance of the Temple Mount is.
The Temple Mount is holy to Christians and Jews, primarily. Jews, because it is the holiest point in the world. It is where Mount Moriah is, where Abraham sacrificed, or almost sacrificed, Isaac. It is where the first and second temple of the Jewish people stood. It was the last stand of the Jewish people against the Romans in Jerusalem. So it is the epicenter of Jewish history. There's no doubt about it. The Christians, of course, because A, it is holy to the Jews, and Christianity is an extension of the history of the Jewish people, it is also holy to the Christians. It is perhaps not always the first in importance, whether it's the tomb, Holy Sepulchre, or whether it's the Vatican, but it is always up there, one and two, because it is incorporated into the theology and the symbolic essence of what Christianity is. It's important to the United States.
Jesus' time in the temple, among other things, right?
Yeah. And it's also important politically to the United States, because we look at ourselves as the New Jerusalem, number one. And number two, we based our concept of Washington being between the various colonies on the basis of King David's choosing of neutral territory between the tribes. So there, Jerusalem plays an important role for us, not so much in Islam.
Yeah, and for these reasons, the Muslim, Sharia supremacists, I call them, have made it a focus of their efforts to seize and exercise control over both the Temple Mount itself and, as you say, one of the very holiest of sites, the Western Wall for the Jews.
They know that the West is anchored to Mount Moriah and Jerusalem symbolically as part of its core soul. And they know that denying that to the Christians and the Jews punches a fatal hole in Judaism and Christianity. So for them, it's the highest strategic target. And its importance to them is largely based on the annulling of Christian and Jewish rights there.
Right. So inciting the Palestinians to act violently on the Temple Mount itself would be a priority, obviously, for Hamas and for Mahmoud Abbas, the ostensible partner for peace, and Fatah, the president of the so-called Palestinian Authority. Why would the United States government, though, be seemingly engaging in incitement as well? And how are they doing it?
Well, I think that there's a more traditional weakness on Jerusalem that emerges from the lack of understanding of history and appreciation of faith among American elites that simply say, ah, it's not that important, just give it to them. If it shuts them up, give it to them, essentially, is the American policy. So in essence, it's to give it to the Muslims to quiet. But I think there's a more dangerous assault here underway, because the key team members of Biden's administration to deal with the Middle East are progressives who have great hostility to the Western idea. So for them, they actually share to some extent the Sharia extremist view of Jerusalem, that if you take down that, you take down Western civilization. It's essentially the equivalent of destroying the statues during the summer of 2020, or the 1619 project, just physically manifest in Jerusalem.
Yeah, and solidarity with the radical jihadists is something that the left has been doing. The red-green axis, we've called it for some time. Talk about the Kingdom of Jordan and what role it is playing with respect to this incitement and the violence that we've now seen on Temple Mount and the demands that Jordan is making to see it end.
Well, Jordan has a peace treaty with Israel, and Jordan has really almost as long as Israel existed had very tight, even secret at times, because before peace, strategic relations with Israel. But since 2017, you've seen a gradual distancing of Jordan from its cooperation with Israel and a switchover. Instead of working with Israel to manage the Palestinian problem, they have more and more become the advocate of Palestinian demands, and lately some of the most extreme Palestinian demands. So in the last few crises, starting in 2017, but especially this round, Jordan crossed red lines. They called on and praised Arabs who were stoning and trying to hurt Jews, and Arabs who were cooperating with the Israeli army and serving in the Israeli army. So Jordan is acting now like a hostile power.
Not a partner for peace, after all. That has a couple of possible implications, David, as I understand it. One is obviously possibly further radicalizing the Palestinians, to be sure, but also possibly destabilizing the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. Might that also be a knock-on effect? And if so, what would the result likely be for, again, not just the Jordanians, but for Israel, perhaps Saudi Arabia and others?
So I'm not a Hashemite or a Jordanian, so I can't say what's in their interests for real. But in essence, the history of it shows that whenever the Jordanian monarchy tries to appease Arab nationalism and Palestinian nationalism, it winds up in a fatal circumstance that needs foreign intervention to save it. The last really serious challenge was in 1970 that wound up in Black September. It's extreme violence where the Israeli army had to take actions to help the Jordanians, the monarch, survive. That's the legacy of attempted appeasements. And the father of this king understood that and stopped after 1970 the periodic attempts to try to appease that, and understood that...
Among other things, by encouraging the creation of a Palestinian state, right?
Exactly. Now this, yeah. Oslo...
We're almost out of time, David. I want to make sure that we don't cut this off, because it seems to me it's of such importance to, well, our interests in the region, as well as those of the King of Jordan and some of our friends, including Israel. So I want to come back to allow you to finish that thought when we get to the other side of this very short break. We'll be right back with more with David Wormser right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas will resume today on Capitol Hill the role he played yesterday as a human piñata pummeled by critics on both sides of the aisle, frantic about the wrecking operation that passes for the Biden administration's immigration policy. Its dismantling of so-called Title 42 will soon see 18,000 aliens illegally entering our country every day. In response to that prospect, Secretary Mayorkas blithely claimed, quote, "We're preparing. We are implementing our plans. We are intensifying our efforts," unquote. Actually, the plan is nothing more than to ensconce those invaders across our country as quickly as possible. If congressional Republicans gain a majority in November, it will be substantially due to the immense harm being done to public health, public safety, and the national security by the Biden-Mayorkas team. They deserve to be impeached for it, and surely will be. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. David Wormser is our guest. We're continuing a really important conversation about what is happening in the Middle East and what might be the upshot of some very misbegotten policy decisions by not only some in the region, but by our own government. And David, you were specifically talking about the Kingdom of Jordan. King Abdullah specifically seems to be making a mistake that has been made from time to time in the past. If indeed he does go the route of trying to appease the aspirations of the Palestinians for their own state, are they likely to wind up with his? And is he likely to wind up dead?
I think it's almost a certainty. I mean, the 1996 peace treaty with Israel, between Jordan and Israel, was based on the fear that Jordan had of the Israeli-Palestinian accords in Oslo and the possibility of a creation of a second of a state, because that takes the Palestinian question and makes it a third radical factor between Jordan and Israel, and that threatens the kingdom profoundly. And as a result, Jordan has worked fairly carefully with Israel to keep that under control. But starting in 2016, really under the Obama administration, we very aggressively pushed the second state solution, undermining Jordan. It cannot survive because Jordan is ultimately based on the Hejazi tribes. It's a tribal structure, and it is ultimately threatened by the Palestinians that more or less make up the northern part of the country, Jordan.
And a large part of the population.
So King Abdullah, by trying to appease them, he will lose the support of his tribes. He will lose the support of the foundation, the core pillar of the regime, which won't be there for him when he's finally challenged by the radicalism he himself has now fueled.
And there's no support for him, I gather, among the Palestinians. So he's going to be toast. And just quickly, David, both Israel and Saudi Arabia would be very much impacted by the replacement of relatively friendly, relatively pro-Western, moderate, responsible ruler in Jordan with who? With a radical Palestinian, would you expect?
Yeah, if there were some breakdown in order in Jordan, these tribes that the Jordanian kingdom was based on stretch all the way down to Mecca and Medina. It forms one of the core structures of the Saudi state, too. And any unrest in that area, especially spreading down to Mecca and Medina, profoundly shake the foundations of the Saudi kingdom as well. So they want Jordan to remain a stable Hashemite kingdom based on tribes. And they see increasingly the Palestinians as a threat to that.
Yes. Another point of connection between the Saudis and the Israelis. And we're on the wrong side of this, I'm afraid, at the moment under this administration. Speaking of on the wrong side and also contributing to the difficulties that we're now facing in this region, David, of course, is the other major focus of your research and analysis, namely what's going on with the U.S. government's efforts to do whatever it takes, and I mean whatever it takes, to get a new deal from these mullahs. We talked earlier in the week about some Israeli reports that the U.S. government has actually realized that this is not going to work out, and they've decided to pull the plug on it. I ask you, is there any evidence that that's actually the case, or do you think the Biden administration is pursuing the same kind of misbegotten policy that it did, many of these people, at least in the previous Obama administration, and compounding the problem of what we just discussed about their wrongheadedness on Palestinian issues?
There's no real evidence that the talks are collapsed, or that we're going to walk away from them, or Iran's going to walk away from them. Really, the opposite. Historically, when the Biden when the Obama administration dealt with Iran, and then the Biden administration, there would be these periodic waves of calming messages to the Israelis, which the Israelis always took seriously, unfortunately, only to be surprised the day after when a deal actually was struck. I think we're in one of those cycles, and I think one of the key pieces of evidence that we are in one of those cycles is that the United States has returned to the key argument it makes for the agreement, which is Iran is weeks away from a bomb, and that therefore you have a binary choice. You let Iran get a bomb, or you go ahead with the agreement, even though it involves some awful concessions that ordinarily we wouldn't want to accept. So they may be telling the Israelis one thing and even signaling publicly the talks are in trouble, but the core message is the signaling that we have to move to an agreement with Iran.
The question that I have for you, David, is I know for a fact that we've been talking about being weeks away from Iran having a bomb, maybe 10 weeks away, for at least a year. And it seems to me that what we're being now told is that there's still some weeks away. At some point, you don't have any more weeks. You don't even have days. Are we at the point where a bomb in the hands of arguably the most dangerous regime on the planet, that doesn't yet have such capabilities at least, is imminent? I mean, like, no kidding, at hand. And something has to be done to stop it other than paying them the money to finish the job, which is what it seems this deal now basically comes down to.
Yeah, you know, first of all, we've got a real problem because in the Ukraine war, our intelligence structures were used, and I'm for defending Ukraine, but it was inappropriate to put out low confidence or no confidence intelligence to make our point on Ukraine, because that really undermined the American credibility, which, despite all the reputation from Iraq and so forth, really has a very good reputation in trying to tell the truth. So we have a problem here when they use these estimates. The second thing is, well, you don't necessarily have a binary choice between the agreement and an Iranian bomb. There are other options, and frankly, options that are far more securing of no bomb in Iran.
Well, and not least of which is fraught, I think we have to acknowledge, but still it is another option, which is that somebody, and it presumably will fall to the Israelis to do, maybe with the help of the Saudis and maybe others, to take out these incipient nuclear capabilities of the Iranian mullahs. And I just would ask you, David, to the extent that a sticking point in these negotiations has been whether the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, the terrorist arm of the regime and essentially its most important security arm, is now removed from the terrorism list. Is that, in fact, as you see it, the sticking point? And do you think that is actually going to prove to be an insuperable problem for this administration?
No, I don't think it'll be an insuperable problem because, first of all, we've already conceded the general point. In public, we say we don't believe the IRGC is a terrorist organization. We just believe elements of it, parts of it, the Al-Quds Force are. So we're already splitting hairs to try to concede to Iran.
I'm fond of saying that there are good terrorists and there are bad terrorists is kind of how this is going to be cast, I suspect.
The argument that Iran is weeks away from a bomb will overpower this. And they'll say, listen, we don't want to remove them from the terrorism list, but we really don't have a choice because we got to stop Iran from getting the bomb. The only way we're going to do it is concede to them on everything else. So,
and just quickly, and we've got 30 seconds, is there any prospect that we will actually stop them from getting the bomb, even if we do make all of these concessions, David Wormser?
No, a serial killer can't be trusted on promises. Iran is as like a serial killer. It is the essence of who they are. So any promise from them is meaningless. We've seen that again and again. So no, you can't. I would only quibble
about one point. I think it's not that they are like a serial killer. The mullahs are serial killers, and they use the RGC for this purpose. David Wormser, we have to leave it at that. Thanks for this update. We'll look forward to more with you shortly. Next up, we're going to talk with Bill Marshall of Judicial Watch about some terrific investigative work that they're doing on the Bidens and more right after this.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. His name is Bill Marshall. He is a senior investigator at an absolutely indispensable organization, Judicial Watch. He brings a lot of experience in both the public sector and private in investigating matters great and small, and we wanted to talk with him about some of the work that he's doing and his organization is at the moment that requires our attention. I think it's a little bit bizarre, frankly, but you've covered it handsomely, Bill, is the attacks that have been taking place. I guess there's been a cessation with the displacement of the perpetrator, but the Biden family dog apparently had a taste for Secret Service personnel and was not terribly restrained by his owners in going after them. Tell us a little bit about what on earth that was all about and why corrective action wasn't taken immediately.
Right. Well, thank you for having me back, Frank. It is one of the more bizarre stories at a national political level that I've worked on in my almost 9 years at Judicial Watch. The Bidens had a dog, a German Shepherd named Major. Who from their first day, virtually their first day or their first day at the White House, had been a direct threat to everyone around him, all the people, including the Secret Service agents. I had actually sent two FOIA requests in the past couple of years about Major Biden, the dog, when there were some initial reports that he had supposedly nipped I think was maybe the phrase that Jen Psaki used, one agent or something like this. So I was curious about that. So I sent a FOIA request initially asking for records about the dog bites. And we got an initial production of 36 pages, which we published last year, which were interesting in that they revealed that the dog had actually attacked numerous Secret Service agents. And then I filed a subsequent request, a broader request, for more records about the dog bites and communications among Secret Service agents. And that produced 400 pages of records. And what I learned, and I can tell you, this is again, a bizarre case from a FOIA standpoint, maybe. I also asked for the dog's vaccination records, by the way. I never got those. But, of course, the Bidens had two dogs. They had an older German Shepherd named Champ, who has sadly passed away last year. And then this young German Shepherd, Major. Now, bear in mind, I'm a dog lover. I own two big dogs myself. I've owned dogs all my life, including German Shepherds. This dog, I want to say, was almost a psychopath, and I never like to blame a dog for its behavior. Ultimately, it's the owners, it's the training that the dog receives that are responsible for the dog's behavior. This dog was so unpredictable and so vicious and aggressive towards Secret Service agents, both uniform division and plainclothes division. Employees, civilian employees of the White House, and guests that were visiting the White House. I also heard through my network that he had attacked a non-Secret Service law enforcement official. Now, I will say that the records we got in the second production were stunning. Okay, in terms of the severity of the attacks that these agents, primarily agents, suffered, and the actions that the agents had to take. They actually had to seek shelter from the dog when it was charging them at times. Some agents, this is a phrase that was used, sought shelter.
Wow. Bill, we're going to run out of time, and I've got other things I want to talk to you about, but I just want to make the case here that what was done by this dog to people who have been willing to sacrifice their lives to protect the first family. And there wasn't corrective action taken, as I said, immediately, is just reprehensible in the extreme, and speaks to me, at least, of an attitude towards these dedicated law enforcement personnel that's pretty contemptible on the part of Biden and his family. And, you know, it raises another question, and I don't think we'll be able to get into it with you today, but the Secret Service has also had some problems, it seems, with penetration of its ranks by some foreign operatives, at least the best we can tell, seemingly with ties to Iran. That's a topic for another day. But, Bill, I just want to say what Judicial Watch does, and you personally especially, with these Freedom of Information Act requests, is bring to light stories about what is going on inside our government. The public has, I think, a right to know about, and it helps, in this case particularly, calibrate on the character of Joe Biden himself, I guess, and certainly his family more broadly. A topic to which, again, we'll return with you. I did want to hit two other issues, though. Speaking of the Biden family, you've done some filings of Freedom of Information Act requests with respect to Hunter Biden, the wayward son, I guess it's fair to say, of the president. Talk a little bit about what you're going after in terms of production of information that has not yet come to light, thanks to his laptop, notably.
Right. I mean, you know, Hunter Biden is almost a godsend, okay, to the American public, okay, in a sort of a backhanded way. You know, he represents, I think, a window into the venality and the corruption and the depravity of the entire Biden family, in my humble opinion. Okay. I've been working on Hunter Biden records as my terrific colleague Sean Dungan has for years. I had gotten records about his travel, while he was under Secret Service protection to 300 or 400 plus countries. while his father was vice president. And of course, we know that he went to China with his father when he inked a huge deal. I think it was a $1.5 billion deal with the Chinese. Okay. And my colleague Sean he was particularly focused on Hunter's dealings in Ukraine when, as you'll recall, Hunter was on the board of Burisma Holdings, which is this oil and this gas, natural gas company, and very corrupt. I mean, this is the State Department's own words, a corrupt organization run by, I believe it's run by a guy named Zlochevsky, a billionaire, and an oligarch, yes. And the Ukrainian prosecutor general was, of course, looking at this company. And you'll recall when Biden was vice president that he famously was on video bragging about how he got he threatened to withhold $1 billion in U.S. funding or U.S. aid from the Ukrainian government if they did not fire the prosecutor that was looking into Burisma and his son, actually Hunter. Because Hunter was on the board of Burisma. I mean, it was, as I think Rudy Giuliani called it, I'm paraphrasing, but he said it was the most concise confession to public corruption that he had ever seen by a political figure, Joe Biden's statement in that talk he gave. So what my colleague Sean filed was a request for all State Department emails and cables referencing Hunter Biden. Because, again, the State Department, our George Kent, who was the deputy chief of mission under the Obama administration for Ukraine, had emailed his boss, Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch, warning her that the Ukrainian, he'd been tipped off by the Ukrainian prosecutor general that a company called Blue Star Strategies, a Democratic PR company lobbying firm in D.C., had approached them in 2016. That is, had approached the Ukrainian prosecutor general offering to connect him to the Clinton campaign. This was during, 2016, the Hillary presidential campaign. So this got back to George Kent, who notified Marie Yovanovitch. George Kent then said to the Ukrainian prosecutor general, steer clear of that, because they were also representing Burisma, and Burisma is corrupt. And by the way, the Clinton Foundation is corrupt. So you don't want to be associated with that, right?
So this is a senior foreign service officer talking about the former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and boy, that's a priceless gem. One of the things that I think we're finding out as we learn more about what's in this laptop is it, of course, was not just Ukraine that was a source of this venality or corruption or however you want to characterize it, compromise of the Biden family, including the big guy. It was, as you've mentioned, communist China. It was also Russia as well. And I guess just to quickly wrap this up, because we're almost out of time, Bill Marshall, looking at this evidence that you and others have compiled, is there any question in your mind that Joe Biden personally, as well as through his various family members, has in fact been compromised by multiple hostile powers, and that's a security problem for the United States as well?
Frank, you and I both worked in the federal government, and we held very high clearances. We know that if we had done anything approaching what the Biden family has done, Joe Biden has done as a public official, we'd be sitting in Leavenworth for decades. Okay, this man is now, of course, Tony Bobulinski, who's Hunter Biden's former business partner, has said that in various communications where they were talking about divvying up equity in certain deals, that 10% would be held for the big guy by Hunter Biden. And Tony Bobulinski has said that the big guy was Joe Biden. Tony Bobulinski had met with Joe Biden.
No doubt about it. He's, I believe, guilty as he should be charged. Bill, we have to leave it at that. This work on the Biden team, or generally by Judicial Watch, is invaluable. Keep it up. Come back to us with updates if you would. We'll speak with Kevin Freeman right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas will resume today on Capitol Hill the role he played yesterday as a human piñata, pummeled by critics on both sides of the aisle, frantic about the wrecking operation that passes for the Biden administration's immigration policy. Its dismantling of so-called Title 42 will soon see 18,000 aliens illegally entering our country every day. In response to that prospect, Secretary Mayorkas blithely claimed, quote, "We're preparing. We are implementing our plans. We are intensifying our efforts," unquote. Actually, the plan is nothing more than to ensconce those invaders across our country as quickly as possible. If congressional Republicans gain a majority in November, it will be substantially due to the immense harm being done to public health, public safety, and the national security by the Biden-Mayorkas team. They deserve to be impeached for it, and surely will be. This is Frank Affney. We're back. Pleased to say we're joined by one of our regulars here at Securing America, the host of his own television program, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. And that would, of course, be Kevin Freeman. He is our duty expert on economic warfare and the very, very considerable damage that is being done by those inflicting it upon us, mostly unbeknownst to Americans. This comes at a moment when we are witnessing now indisputably the advent of significant stagflation. A negative GDP has just been announced, as well as the highest inflation in 40 years. To talk about all of it and what it means for both the investments that Wall Street continues to insist we make in our mortal enemy, Communist China, and also what they're doing in Washington at the moment to dethrone the dollar as the world's reserve currency, is our friend Kevin Freeman. Welcome back, Kevin. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank.
Let's start with the first issue, Kevin. You have been very, very clear-eyed and a clarion voice, really, on the issue of the Chinese Communist Party, the threat that it represents to us, and specifically the unrestricted warfare it has been engaging in for, well, at least 20 years. Talk a little bit about that and how economic warfare features in that overall strategy.
Well, Frank, there's no question that the Chinese understood 20 plus years ago that as long as America's economy was the strongest in the world, that they could not dethrone us. So they began a process. You labeled it unrestricted warfare. That's the best English translation we can get. But that means all-out war, war in every respect, cultural warfare, rare mineral warfare, every type of warfare. And at the center of all of it is this notion that if we take down the American economy, we will not be able to fund a military. And economic warfare is something the Reagan administration used against the Soviet Union, and the Chinese have been focused on it, undermining us, infiltrating us, stealing our capital, stealing our inventions and ideas, everything possible to take America down. And this GDP print that you just mentioned, that we went negative in this mass inflation time, we went negative. I mean, that's horrifying. A combination of what the Chinese are doing and what the Biden policies have done has put us in a very difficult spot.
You mentioned capital theft. I wish it were thievery. It's diversion for sure from, well, patriotic investing, but towards our enemies, but it's been voluntary. It's been engineered as, I guess, part of the elite capture of old friends, as they call them on Wall Street, helping voluntarily migrate trillions of dollars from mostly unwitting American investors to China. What is that about, Kevin? Give us a sense of the magnitude of it and the damage that it's done.
Well, I think you could more, okay, so if it's not theft, it's co-option, it's bait and switch, it's fraud, it's all of these notions that Wall Street told us that the future of the world is China, and therefore we have to invest in China. That was a ridiculous notion 25 years ago. It's a ridiculous notion today. Their economy, the way that their government manipulates and controls their people is not conducive to good, wonderful economic growth going forward. It is, you know, a totalitarian state that is repressing really wonderful people who have all sorts of economic opportunity, but are being controlled so tightly that it's a bad investment. And yet Wall Street has profited by this globalization idea. We haven't been exporting American notions and ideals and liberty to China. China has been taking our economy piece by piece, bit by bit. Theft is one way to say it, but co-option or fraud is another.
Yeah, warfare is the bottom line for sure. And Kevin, the underwriting that we've done is enabling the rest of the unrestricted warfare. I think that's for sure. You have done yeoman's work now for 10 years or so to try to assure investors that if they don't want to be putting their money into our mortal enemy, their financial advisors can ensure that they still make money, but invest patriotically. Tell us about your initiative and an important development just in the past couple of days.
Well, the key is that it's not Wall Street's money. Wall Street invests for their customers, and the customers don't want China, particularly after COVID. But also they see...
You've actually poll tested that proposition, right?
Tell us absolutely.
About your finding.
Absolutely. And here's the bait and switch. ESG, we're being forced on us this idea of being environmentally friendly, social justice and governance on American companies. And then they take that money and invest it in China, which is, again, a bait and switch. It's a fraud because the Chinese are not good on any of that. They're not good for the environment. And I don't mean the people. I mean the government is bad for the environment. It's bad for social justice and everything else. Well, when we ask people, do you want your money invested to benefit America patriotically, or do you want it to invest it along these lines? Without hesitation, people say, I want my money invested patriotically. Wall Street's not been giving them that option. So we've gone around Wall Street to the local client-facing financial advisor with this, what you've deemed the mad as hell campaign. I don't want to be funding the demise of America. I don't want to be funding the rise of the Communist Party. So get my money out of that and put it in stuff that's good. And we train financial advisors. We just got word that our course is live, meaning we can start registering advisors for training at Liberty University. That's who's hosting our course for us. It's an 8-week training program. We walk through all of these issues with a financial advisor. Ask me who I want managing my money. I want someone who understands the things we're teaching.
So they can find it at the National Security Investment Consultants Institute. An economic war room, is that the easiest way to do that?
NSIC.org or economicwarroom.com/advisor will let you know how your advisor can. If you go to economicwarroom.com/advisor, you can nominate your advisor and they can come do our training.
We really need you to do that too. Kevin Freeman, we have to take a short break. We're going to come right back with more about dethroning the dollar. Kevin Freeman, straight ahead. Welcome back. And again, a very special welcome to our guest, Kevin Freeman, a duty regular here on economic warfare issues. And Kevin, as long as I've known you, you have been raising an alarm about another very serious manifestation of economic warfare, arguably the single most devastating thing that the Chinese Communist Party, the Russians, or others could do to us economically, and that is ending the reign of the dollar as the world's reserve currency. It seems as though something that, again, you've forecast, a lot of others said couldn't happen or certainly wouldn't happen anytime soon, is now upon us. Give us an update on that problem as you see it today.
Yeah, and people don't think about this because everything we do in transactions is in dollar terms, but they don't realize that our federal government has borrowed $30 trillion. And to put it into context, the average household, let's say if your household was earning $40,000 a year, you were spending $50,000 or $60,000 a year, and you owed $300,000 in debt. Well, that's kind of the situation the federal government is in right now.
And a lot of that has been amassed in just the past year, has it not?
When Bush left office, it was around $10 trillion. It is now $30.5 trillion. So it is an enormous ramp up. We are essentially broke.
Yeah. How is that now manifesting itself in an unwillingness of some people to use the dollar any longer, for example, purchases of energy?
Well, we had made arrangements that the dollar would be used whenever oil was purchased, but now the Saudis, and this is a part of our debt and part of the policy of this administration. Pro-Iran policies make the Saudis question whether or not they need to support the dollar. The Russians are getting people to trade for natural gas in rubles and not in dollars. People don't need dollars or want dollars around the world like they did before, so who's going to finance our debt? Where's that $30 trillion going to come from? How do we finance it? If we lose the dollar as a reserve currency of the world, it puts us in a situation like Zimbabwe when their currency collapsed, or Argentina, or more recently Venezuela, or Germany during the 1930s. So keeping the dollar's respect around the world is absolutely essential. At the same time, the Chinese, the Russians, the North Koreans, the Iranians, and others have said, hey, let's work together and dethrone the dollar. And some of our allies, including India and Saudi Arabia and Israel and others, well, maybe we don't need as many dollars. This is a existential threat to the viability of the United States as an ongoing entity.
Right. And the Russians are now insisting that their purchases be made in rubles. And I gather European countries have been opening ruble accounts for the purpose. So this is another tectonic shift. Kevin, again, I want to commend you for not just worrying about these sorts of problems or telling the rest of us we better be worrying about them, but doing something proactively to try to address the problems you've identified. Talk a little bit about what you are calling the digital Texan.
Right. Well, Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution says basically states can't print their own money, but they can, given a Supreme Court ruling and what it says in the Constitution, they can take gold and silver on deposit and create literally a gold standard and then apply cryptocurrency capability on top of it. And so we're working with the state of Texas to hopefully implement a digital Texan, which would function and work as a money supply alternative should the dollar fail. And the beauty of it is if we get it up and operating, it makes it less likely that someone will try and take the U.S. dollar down because they know that it wouldn't succeed in destroying America as a country. So it's something we've been working on for a long time. It has great promise. It's the ability to own gold and silver without worrying about taxation and have it guaranteed. So it's gold and silver. It is a big inflation hedge. It's a really creative thing that was put in the Constitution by our founders that a state can now exploit, and not just Texas, Florida or Nevada or New Jersey or Alaska or Oklahoma. They're all open to do it. And we just want to pioneer and show the way here in Texas.
The key piece of this, as far as I'm concerned, Kevin, is that, as you have also indicated, there's a danger that if you have these central bank digital currencies, CBDCs as they're called, emerging, that you might find them turning into programmable currency and tied in with a social credit system of the kind China uses to control the use that's made of this money or of other behavior of those who hold it. Talk a little bit about the privacy practices that you are trying to make sure get baked into this vision of the digital Texan.
Well, the beauty of paper currency is that you can go and spend it and they don't track you with it. I mean, they can if they go to elaborate means, but it's not simple. The central bank digital currencies are designed to track and control everything. They're designed by George Orwell himself, almost. And the idea is that if you have digital dollar or digital yuan or digital ruble, they can control every aspect of your life, how you spend it, where you spend it, whether or not you're allowed to spend it, track you when you do spend it. We think that is anti-constitution. So when we create the digital Texan, one big push is to have privacy rights to where you have the anonymity, like you do with a Bitcoin right now. And unless they have a court order and really dig into it, they're not going to be able to find anything or track you in any way. And I think that's essential for a free society, that we have the right to act as economic beings without centralized control of every decision. That's the difference between liberty and communism.
Right. And unfortunately, what we're seeing, I think clearly in the case of the Chinese yuan and probably that of other central banks, is a penchant for that control. And Kevin, this is a really inspiring alternative to it. We commend you for your leadership on it and look forward to hearing more about it in the days to come. I want to thank you for being with us. As always, Kevin, it's great to have a chance to visit with you. And as I say, your leadership on all of these issues is inspiring as well as much needed. I want to thank the rest of you for being with us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped as a result to join us in doing just that. You can find out more about how to do that at our programs at securingamerica.tv. And then, as I'm fond of saying, I hope you will go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.